Hi everybody, today is Monday, April 28th, 2025, and our friend Colonel Jacques-Beau is back with us. Welcome back, Colonel.
Thank you very much for inviting me, and hello to everybody.
We had a meeting between Donald Trump and Zelensky in Italy, in Rome, and it seems Zelensky was asking, as Donald Trump has mentioned in his sort of talk with the press, that Zelensky was asking for more weapons. And I don't know if you noticed the role of Emmanuel Macron. He was going to participate somehow in the talks, and then he was rejected. How can we understand that? And here is what Marco Rubio said, Colonel, in terms of what's going on, the current situation of talks, of negotiations between the United States and Russia.
Frustrations that he is voicing, Mr. Secretary, why hasn't he imposed sanctions yet?
Well, because I think we're still hoping to see that this effort works out in diplomacy and that we can bring these two sides closer together. I mean, the minute you start doing that kind of stuff, you're walking away from it. You've now doomed yourself to another 2 years of war, and we don't want to see it happen. I think what's important and really weighs is there is no other country. There is no other institution or organization on the earth that can bring these two sides together. No one else is talking to both sides but us. And no one else in the world can make something like this happen but the president. This is a very significant responsibility and a really important opportunity. And we want to make sure that we work it all the way through, that we don't walk away from something that can actually work or that can actually lead to peace. But we also don't want to continue to spend time on something that's not going to get us there. So throughout this process, it's about determining, do both sides really want peace, and how close are they or how far apart they are after 90 days of effort here, over 90 days of effort. That's what we're trying to determine this week. There are reasons to be optimistic, and there are also reasons to be concerned. It's complicated. If this was an easy war to end, it would have been ended by someone else a long time ago. But right now, the only one who can bring these two sides together to end this war is our president, President Trump. And we're doing everything we can to see if we can get that done here over the next few days.
And if they want to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine, why do they need to send more weapons to Ukraine? Which it seems that Emmanuel Macron is advocating for that. And here is people in France protesting that.
Macron, ta guerre, on n'en veut pas. Macron, ta guerre, on la frappe pas.
Colonel, people are not happy with sending weapons, more weapons to Ukraine. They don't want to die in this war in Ukraine. They don't see an end to it. But how do you see the way that Emmanuel Macron is behaving, for example? And because one of the main factors that Marco Rubio was mentioning is the continuation of the conflict. They're getting to some point that they feel they cannot reach a deal. We know how important the role of Europe is right now.
Well, of course, the question you ask is requires a lot of answers. It's very a complex thing. So what we have seen in the Vatican is apparently, I say apparently because even in France there are some debates about what really happened, but apparently Zelensky wanted to talk to President Trump. And Macron came and apparently wanted also to be part of the discussion. There is a sense in Europe that if Zelensky and Trump would talk together, eventually Trump will prevail. And that's the reason why they always try to short circuit this relationship or discussion or possible discussions between Zelensky and Trump. And by the way, I think the Trump team has understood that. And that's the reason why we had all these discussions in Jeddah and Riyadh and not in France, in Brussels, or somewhere else in Europe, because the Americans have sensed that the Europeans always try to get some kind of influence over Zelensky in order to avoid any kind of a settlement or discussion or talks happening. And that's my interpretation and the interpretation of many, that it's exactly what we have seen at a reduced scale in the Vatican, because there was those three chairs that were prepared for three people. Some said it was for the translator, but Zelensky speaks perfectly English, or at least enough English to be understood by Donald Trump. So there was no need for a translator. And therefore, this third chair was most probably for Emmanuel Macron, who tried to impose himself in the discussion. And he was politely rejected by Donald Trump. And eventually we had this discussion between both Zelensky and Trump alone. So, and we see also in the proposal that was made by the Europeans. I mean, last week in London, you had two position papers that were confronting each other. The one proposed by the Americans, I would say in the right order, I would say the one proposed by Europe and Ukraine, and the one proposed by the Americans, which in fact was patterned over the one, it's based on the Kellogg concept or plan, or you can call it as you want, but rearranged or patterned on the basis of the Ukrainian Euro proposal. And you had two different papers with significant differences. But in a significant difference between the two is that the Americans propose to mediate, in fact, or to, how to say that, to propose talks or to sponsor talks between Ukraine and Russia, but without being part of the talks. So in fact, the Americans just want to press the two parties to go to the table. The Europeans have a different approach. They want a discussion where you have on one side the Europeans, the US and Ukraine, and on the other side, Russia. And that's very clear in the paper. So there is always this idea that Ukraine is a junior team, if you want, and the senior team must sponsor or help or guide or direct the junior Zelensky team. And that's I think it's not a good approach. I think the American approach in that case is probably make more sense. We have to the, I mean, Rubio said in a previous interview that it was a proxy war between the US and Russia. This is clear. Rubio understands, as the rest of the team, the Trump team, that it was a proxy war between the Biden administration and Russia. But that's, I think it's important to understand. And as Trump has said repeatedly, he doesn't consider the war as his war. This is Biden's war. And therefore, that allows him, this posture allows him to take the position of a mediator. He can mediate the discussion and prompt or provoke or press the two parties to go to the negotiation table. I think that's the way it happens, and the way the Americans want to keep it. They don't want to be involved, because that would mean they are continuing the Biden strategy, and they don't want that. We have also to acknowledge, and that's also the reason why Trump is the only Western leader who can talk to the Russians, because it's no break with his previous policy, if you want. But for all the others, let's take Emmanuel Macron or Keir Starmer, they have been adamant to continue the war. So now they are trapped in their own narrative. They cannot really go backwards and say, oh, now we have to sponsor a dialogue with Russia. So Trump, because you had this election and because he was elected last year and came into office in January, he has the luxury of looking at the conflicts from outside, if I can put it that way, as in my view, the Europeans should do. I mean, I always said, Zelensky is a Ukrainian for good or bad reasons, probably bad reasons, but my assessment. But for good or bad reason, he's in the conflict and he has a position, obviously, against the Russians because this is the enemy. On the other side, you have the Russians, and they have a similar position. They are involved in a conflict. They consider Ukraine as the enemy. Therefore, you have two parties considering the other as an enemy. That's normal. But I still don't understand why outside observers are still considering being part of the conflict. And that's exactly the position, European position. They are part of the conflict, in fact. And they behave as if they were Ukrainians. And even if they never came up with any solution to the conflict, not even military, they just provided weapons, but they fed the conflict rather than finding solutions. And both politically, that means diplomatically, and militarily, European was never tried to find an exit. They had no exit strategy. They had no exit policy. And it didn't help Ukraine to get out of the conflict. So now they want to be part of the discussion. But there have been exactly those who have prevented Ukraine to talk. Remember what happened in February 2022, later in April 2022, and later in August 2022, when every time Zelensky tried to open the dialogue with Russia, because from the very beginning of the Russian special military operation, Zelensky felt that he went on the wrong direction. And that's the reason why already one day after the beginning of the special military operation, he asked for negotiations. So Zelensky probably intuitively understood that what he hoped to have to be an easy victory over Russia because of the sanctions and all that, he felt that it was wrong and tried to move backwards. But who prevented that? On the 27th of February 2022, European Union came and said, no, the discussion that were going on in Gomel at the Ukrainian-Belarusian border, European Union said, no, there will be no discussion. We provide 550 million euro of weapons for Ukraine. No discussion. They repeated exactly the same thing in end of March 2022 as you had the discussions, and that was reported by the Financial Times at the time and by the Ukrainian press, including Ukrainskaya Pravda and so on. And then the European Union came again. They came back with a second package of half a billion euro for weapons. Say, no, you don't talk. You fight. So you have this constant pressure of the Europeans to continue war despite what Zelensky wanted. And now you want those same Europeans be at the negotiation table with Ukrainians. It's totally absurd. And that's the reason why I think the Trump team has understood that if you want to achieve anything in terms of a dialogue or a discussion, or at least opening a dialogue, you need to keep the Europeans far away from the negotiation table, because they will not be a factor of peace, they will be a factor of war. And we can definitely see that in the project they have submitted at the so-called London conference last week. Coming back to what Marco Rubio, I always used to say.
Secretary of State,
obviously. Coming back to what Rubio said, it's true, and that is to the credit of Donald Trump, is that at least he's willing to engage the Russians on the issue of peace negotiation, and is ready to engage the Ukrainians as well. So at least someone in the West is ready to talk to the Russians. And I think that's obviously to his credit. The problem is that, as we have said many times, he has a good intention, which is to disengage the US from this conflict, and by the same token, to have probably an agreement between the two parties, which is good intention. Problem is, again, that he has no strategy to address that. And that's a real problem, because that explains exactly what we have seen in the last months, it's more than a couple of months now, that we are going back and forth. Nobody knows exactly. We talk about negotiation, but there have been no negotiation yet on a peace. What we have seen so far are, in fact, two sets of discussions. The first one is a first discussion between the US and Russia in order to restore normal diplomatic relations, including the reopening of the embassies in Moscow and in Washington, D.C., and to have a normal diplomatic flow of relation, if you want. That's the first step. And that's what happened in Riyadh and Istanbul and more recently in Jeddah. In Istanbul, I think. It was on the 10th of April. Anyway, so that was the first set of discussions. And then you had another set of discussions between Witkoff and Putin, between Trump and Zelensky, and including the discussion and the conference in London. And this second set of discussions is about establishing or setting kind of a position paper for the parties, because precisely the Trump administration started this process with on the backdrop of this article of Keith Kellogg that he wrote early April 2024, and what was published on the website of the America First Policy Institute. But that was just an article that was essentially a criticism about Biden's policy, but there was no plan yet. Since then, Keith Kellogg has worked this article out in order to have some kind of a plan. And all the efforts of the Trump administration in the last couple of months was to have the Europeans agreeing on that position, which is a position paper, period. The discussions between Witkoff and Putin was for Witkoff to understand the Russian position and to understand up to which point the Russians are ready to, up to which point they are ready to talk, and what is negotiable, what is not. This is something that And that was a criticism that has been made by others, Alexander Mekuritz and others, that the Case-Kellogg so-called plan never took into consideration what the Russians said. And the baseline for the Russians have been clearly explained by Vladimir Putin on the 14th of June, 2024, just before the so-called peace conference in Bürgenstock in Switzerland. And there he set the two basic conditions to enter into the negotiation process. So it's not something to be negotiated. This is something that this is the threshold that Russia will have, will demand in order to start the process. And namely, Ukraine out of NATO and the Russian authority or sovereignty over the four regions of Kherson, Zaporozhye, Donetsk, and Lugansk. That's it. There are no other requests. These are the two requests. And when you look at the Case-Kellogg plans and the variants of it and all that, he never took these basic conditions into account in today. Because any plan, basically, any plan that you would draw should take into account this, because otherwise the Russians would simply not take part of the negotiation. So there is no point having what was proposed both by the Europeans and by the Americans at the London conference was to have this recognition of the Russian authority based on the contact line. So based on the military front line, which excludes basically one third of Zaporozhye, Kherson, and Donetsk Republic. So there is no chance that the Russians will start any negotiation process without this baseline. Meaning that any plan should start with that. And that was not the case. And that's the reason why the Trump nominated or asked Witkoff to discuss with Putin in order to see what is the margin or the freedom of movement, if you want. Because at the end of the day, what we will have are two positions. You will have a Ukrainian position, obviously or hopefully agreed upon by the Western actors, let's put it that way. And you will have a Russian position. Obviously, the two papers or the two positions will differ significantly. And that's the purpose of the discussion, the negotiation. When you negotiate, it's precisely to bring together positions that are essentially different, but progressively, by giving something to other and taking, it's a give and take exercise that you do, and progressively, incrementally, you should have those two positions coming closer and closer to each other to reach a common position, which eventually will be an agreement. That's the process. I've been part of several discussion of this kind, and it's a very tedious process because you come from a very solid position and then you know that you will have to give something to the other in order to have the other also giving something in return, and therefore the two positions will get closer. But the problem is that, as I said, Trump knows probably where he's heading to, probably, but he has no very clear objectives on that, but certainly no strategy. And the Europeans on their side have neither a strategy nor an objective, or I should say the other way around. They don't have an objective. They don't have any strategy to reach that objective. And that's the problem of the Europeans, because if you don't know where you are heading to, it's very hard to get there. You know, and that's exactly the problem of the European Union. And when you, if you talk to people like Emmanuel Macron, who change their mind every second day, I mean, there is no way you will achieve anything. And that's, that was the purpose of the London conference, to agree on a common position paper in order to support Ukraine in the discussion with Russia. Because it needs, Ukraine needs to have a departure position. You see? And that was exactly the problem. So there have been no negotiations so far, or let's say not between with the Russians. It's just a matter of understanding who has which position and what, where are the position of departure for both sides. And that's where we are here. And in that sense, Marco Rubio is right when he says, at least you have only one Western leader who is ready to address this question, and that's Trump, with the risk, of course, that if he doesn't achieve anything in the short term, that will become his war. And that's the reason also why he's reluctant to provide any support, weaponry and all that, because he doesn't want this conflict to be his war. He would like this conflict to be his peace and leave the war aspect to Biden. You see, that's where we are. And that explains the reason why Rubio said that if the Europeans are not able to find a reasonable position, then US will withdraw and they will leave the baby, Ukraine, in the arms of the Europeans. And that is a guarantee for failure. Because any conflict, regardless of the conflict, a military conflict, can end in two different ways. A, it's a negotiated solution around the table that you discussed, or through a decisive victory of one of the belligerents. And if we were in a situation such as probably March 2022, when more or less everything was open, then you could have a position like the Europeans and say, okay, we continue, we can take the risk of continuing fighting because there is a chance on both sides to win. But now we are in a very, very different position today, that first of all, definitely we have seen that since summer 2023, that the Russians are the dominating power and they are winning. They are the winning side. And there is nothing that indicates that Russia is weakened or that the course of events can be reversed. Meaning that, and on the other hand, by the way, on the Ukrainian side, we see a shrinking armored forces with less and less equipment. And we can say that since the end of 2022, all the equipment, old former Soviet equipment that Ukraine still had, has totally disappeared from the battlefield. If you look at the pictures we have seen in the Kursk area, for instance, or in other areas, we just see Western equipment. M113, I don't remember the name of those armored trucks that were used for made for Iraq and now used by the Ukrainians. These are all U.S. equipment, basically. You don't have original Russian equipment anymore. So, and all that is shrinking. If you see the amount of vehicles and equipment that has been destroyed by the Russians just in Kursk, you can see that the equipment of the Ukrainian army is shrinking at enormous high speed. And at the same time, they have problem with the personnel. And that's the reason why they opened the possibility of having people younger than 25 years of age of being involved or part of the armed forces. So we see that on the Ukrainian side, things are not going so well. I'm not even talking about the economy and all that, but that comes into addition. So it's not the right moment to speculate on a possible Ukrainian success. And that's exactly what the Europeans are doing. So I think the approach that the Europeans have to press Ukraine not to negotiate with Russia and continue fighting, even if we accept it would have made some sense in March 2022. Today has no sense anymore. And that's the recipe for the total destruction of Ukraine. And that's what Vladimir Putin, by the way, indicated just a few days ago when he said, we'll finish them off. You know? So we have here a very interesting situation in which we know that Ukraine is on the verge of being totally defeated. And there is no, let's say, a visible solution for that. But at the same time, you have the Europeans who don't have the slightest idea of how to find a solution to the problem, who don't have any idea about some kind of exit strategy, but they are still promoting the idea of continuing fighting. So this is, of course, there are a lot of denial behind this, but behind the denial, I think there is a certain intellectual problem there, because I don't see, well, I mean, it's always easy to make war with the blood of others. And that's exactly what the Europeans are doing. They are making war with the blood of the Ukrainians. And it's easy to do so. But in the reality, we are probably in the same kind of madness that we had during the First World War, where people always hoped for the victory tomorrow, but it never happened. And so we killed a lot of people for nothing, just because we hoped that somehow victory would fall from the sky. And we are exactly in the same situation in Europe. So that definitely raised some concerns, at least to me.
Colonel, who's in the driving seat in Europe? Is there any evidence for that, for to see who's driving the show, who's running the show in Europe? We know that Germany, together with the United Kingdom and France, are the major parties, but I don't see that much of a role for Germany between the United Kingdom and France. Who's the main player of the game in Ukraine?
And that's another problem. There are none. You know, it's not a collective there are no collective vision of that. I mean, yes, there's a collective vision in a sense that they want to have Russia defeated, but that's just a mindset. So this is not a strategy, you know. When you talk about who is in the driving seat, when you ask who is in the driving seat, we see that we have a multiple one-man show. You have Macron making his show. You have Ursula von der Leyen making hers. Kaya Kallas making hers. Keir Starmer making his. And Merz, who tries to find some place in the spotlight. But we see that this coalition of the willing that was supposed to gather all Europeans under the same idea, with the same objective, and with the same approach to the conflict, failed totally. You see that the Italians are less emotional than the French, probably more pragmatic. That's also Giorgia Meloni, the Italian prime minister, doesn't like Macron. That's the first thing. She just hates him. Because probably she understands that Macron is a guy who shows off. That's all. There is no substance behind Macron. He's just someone who talks nice buzzwords, find the right expression, or is very keen to be in the limelight, but there is no real substance in what he thinks. There is no, and that explains why he changed so often his position, and he flip-flops all the time, because there is no real understanding of the problem, first of all. There is no strategy to address. I mean, though, let's say, intellectual perception of a solution has none. And we see that not only as regard Ukraine, by the way, but we see that internally. And probably because in France itself, he's not able to have precisely the right strategy to address problems in France, that he tries to have a higher profile on the foreign policy stage. That's probably the reason. But we see that he tries to engage in various, he tried also with Iran, with Palestine and all that. But since he has no solid understanding, solid views on how this conflict should be treated, it doesn't last long. So he just here to be in the headlines, and then he vanishes. So there is nobody there. And Keir Starmer, it's very similar that Macron, probably less flamboyant than Macron in a certain sense, because he makes a lot of promises, but he has not the means to fulfill those promises. He knows it. And that's also the same with Merz, but with a different perspective, because Merz understands in Germany that the whole population, and we see that through the growth of in importance of the AfD, this right-wing party, which is very adverse to European Union, at least the foreign policy of the European Union, and adverse to any attempt to go to war with Russia. And its importance is growing in Germany. And I think now it has become, in terms of what the poll says, I mean, that is always subject to caution, but apparently today the AfD is the most popular party in Germany. And it's not a party that belongs to the current governing coalition. So Merz has not a total freedom when deciding. He has no real majority behind him to make decisions such as going deeper into the war in Ukraine. So he's halfway, if you want. Meaning that if you look at those main actors, and I'm not even mentioning Ursula von der Leyen and Kaya Kallas, because these are people who have not been able to develop a sound and reasonable, I would say, strategy for Ukraine. In the last 3 years, their only input was to provide new weapons. They never came up with any idea to solve the issue, even before, by the way, because Ursula von der Leyen was one of those Western leaders who advised Zelensky not to fulfill the Minsk agreements. So basically, we see people who act in a very emotional way. And when I say emotional, it's not, it's the real term, because when we see the reaction, for instance, when we talk about the Victory Day, the 9th of May in Moscow, and when you see that the European Union is now preventing or tries to prevent anyone from the leaders, the European leaders, to go and assist the parade in Moscow, that means that those people, and Ursula von der Leyen is a German, her grandfather used to work with those who occupied Ukraine, in fact. So these people have not swallowed the victory in 1945. That's the real thing. Somehow they have not swallowed the victory. And therefore they are totally directed against Russia. So there is no way we can expect any sensible solutions coming from them. So coming back to your question, no, there is nobody in the driving. There are some views that are more, I mean, again, the only common point or common aspiration, if you want, is to see Russia being defeated. But there is no agreement on how to achieve that, with what, which means, and what for. Because when, if you want, let's assume, I mean, I understand the Ukrainians, they want Russia out of Ukraine. Okay, that's legitimate. That's their country. They want to have their country as it used to be. I mean, if they had thought about the problem before, probably the Russians would have not come in the first instance. But okay, they had bad policies that eventually led the Russians to come and make their operation. But okay, let's forget that. And we understand that the Ukrainians would prefer to have no Russians in Ukraine. I understand that. But what is the idea of Ursula von der Leyen? It goes beyond of that. And we have heard Kaya Kallas last year saying that the name of the game is not simply to have the Russians out of Ukraine. The name of the game is to have Russia disintegrating, or better said, in the official State Department terminology, to have Russia decolonizing or split among different ethnic groups that compose the whole Federation of Russia. And so that the goal is to have Russia split into pieces. That's the ultimate goal. And again, okay, they have this idea, but they don't know how to achieve that. And that will certainly not be achieved by simply supporting Ukraine. So these are people who simply hate Russia for various reasons, probably because of history or family history, but they hate Russia. So they support Ukraine, knowing that Ukraine eventually will probably be destroyed, but not knowing how to achieve that, having no strategy, no real objective or tangible, concrete objective, and no strategy to address these objectives. So we have, that's why I said, we have a sum of one-man shows rather than one single view on the how to solve the crisis.
Colonel, the other conflict for the United States is the situation in the Middle East and the talks between Iran and the United States. We had the third round of negotiation and talks. And in this round, it was not only by diplomats talking to each other, but technical teams are somehow negotiating with each other to find a solution for the conflict with Iran. Here is what Netanyahu said, and I would assume that he wants to put pressure on Netanyahu, on Donald Trump.
A deal that works is a deal which removes Iran's capacity to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons. By the way, the only reasons you enrich uranium is to have nuclear weapons. There are dozens and dozens of countries who have civilian nuclear programs, and they don't enrich uranium. So Iran is constantly thinking, well, we have to find a reason why we're putting these things in bunkers under mountains, maybe for radioisotopes, right, for medicine, or for nuclear submarines. Give me a break. They enrich uranium for one reason and one reason only, and that's to make nuclear weapons, which they intend to use to destroy my country and threaten America. Once they have the weapons of delivery, ballistic missiles, ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, they will threaten every city in the United States. That is a palpable danger to Israel and to the free world, and it must be prevented. The way to prevent it is to dismantle all the infrastructure of Iran's nuclear program. That is a deal we could live with.
You get the tone of his argument. And with what's going on, with what we've heard from the teams, from the two parties, do you think it's just some sort of fantasy for Netanyahu? Because it doesn't seem that the American part is asking for that.
No, the Americans are not asking for that. And what we hear from Netanyahu today is in fact the continuation of a constant idea, not really a policy, but an idea of the Israelis since the early 50s to have the U.S. physically engage in the Middle East. That was a constant effort of the Israelis. And it started, in fact, with the famous Lavon affair in Egypt in the early 50s, in which the Israelis started a bombing campaign in Egypt, bombing U.S. and British interests and consulate embassies and things like that, in order to provoke British and or American intervention in Egypt, in order to have them physically committed to the Middle East. This became the you can see, check it in the Lavon affair in Wikipedia, for instance, even if Wikipedia is a very bad source for information at large, but okay. That became the Lavon affair because this bombing campaign, which is essentially a terrorist campaign, was sponsored by the Israeli intelligence, military intelligence at that time, if I'm not wrong. Lavon was the Minister of Defense. And that was one of those attempts to have the Americans involved in the region. So, and since then, it has been a constant same approach of the Israelis. And now we have this. I mean, that's why I always say Iran is the best enemy of Israel. I mean, Iran has absolutely nothing against Israel. They have no common borders. They don't have contentious issues, essentially. See, Israel has a problem with Iran, but Iran has no problem with Israel. But Israel has a problem with all its neighbors, so it's not really a surprise. Now, if we go back to what Netanyahu said, Iran is enriching uranium, and it's true. And this has been inspected by the international
IAEA,
exactly. Many times. And in fact, it gives the answer why Iraq enriched uranium. It's because precisely other countries don't have the capacity to do it. And in fact, for Iran, enriching uranium and selling enriched uranium is a business. So that's the perspective that we have from Netanyahu, that the only purpose of enriching uranium is to have nuclear weapons, is stupid. It's wrong. It's a lie. There are other applications, and Iranians are selling that. And that was set into the Joint Comprehensive Agreement on for Iran, the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action for Iran. That was set in that. It was authorized for Iran to have enrichment capabilities and capacities in order to sell that to other countries. The problem is that this enrichment process cannot be stopped. And since the US has prohibited any trade with Iran, Iran has been is constrained to keep and to store this enriched equipment, uranium. But in fact, it's not enriched to the military grade level, and it is still commercial grade. And it can be sold to other partners. Now, another element that we need to, because Netanyahu wants to delegitimate the right for Iran to enrich uranium, in the JCPOA, as in the status of the IAEA, it is explicitly said that enriching uranium is an inalienable right of countries. Inalienable right. Meaning that every country who has obviously the capacity to do it is entitled to enrich uranium, not for the purpose of making weapons, but for commercial issues. And let me remind you that just a couple of weeks ago, as Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence, presented the annual report on the threat situation situation in the world, she explicitly said, and it's explicitly written in the report, by the way, that as it was already stated in a national intelligence estimate of the CIA in 2007, that Iran has stopped its idea of having nuclear weapons in 2003. And since then, it has not made any plan to resume the research on and the development of nuclear weapons. That was said, and she said exactly that the international intelligence community assesses that since 2003, Iran has no longer any plan to to have nuclear weapons. So Netanyahu is lying. And even the Americans have said that in 2007. There's a famous, you can download it. It was, you can find it on the internet. There's this national intelligence estimate of, I think it was October 2007 or November. I don't remember. Anyway. And now the intelligence community repeats exactly the same thing, exactly the same wording as it was in the national estimate of 2007, that since 2003, there is no development of nuclear weapons, and there is no intent to do it. And I remember that, I think it was in 2012 or something like that, as you had Netanyahu talking at the UN General Assembly with the famous drawing with the bomb that was drawn on a paper, and he was with a marker marking the red line and you know the different steps of producing a nuclear weapon. And that was September 2012, if I'm not wrong. And just weeks after that, you had a leaked document of the Mossad that appeared and said that there is no indication whatsoever, that Iran was developing a nuclear weapon. So that was, and probably the leak was intentional, because that was probably a way to say that Netanyahu just lied to the international community, and he's constantly lying. That's the trouble with this guy, because everything he say is demonstrably wrong, and has been demonstrably debunked by intelligence organization, including the IAEA, and the international it's always IAEA,
international
Energy, exactly. I always mix, because there is the acronym in French, the acronym in English.
So it's difficult to get both
mixing the different. Yeah. When you work with different languages, it's always a problem. Sometimes I mix Italian, German, and English and French, so it becomes a mess in my head. But more seriously, coming back to this, before, and I mentioned the JCPOA before, and just before Trump left the JCPOA in 2017 or something like that, the IAEA had made 17 inspections of Iran. And on 17 occasions, the agency confirmed that Iran was complying with the treaty. So when we look at official statements and international organizations, US intelligence, we see that they are consistently saying that Iran has no intent to develop a nuclear weapon and has not made any step to do so. Remember that before that, in the early 2000s, Iran considered the idea of having a nuclear weapon, and they studied the feasibility. They made a feasibility study of that. The CIA tried to, they had an operation for against that. They managed to provide Iranians with the blueprints of a nuclear weapon, but in this blueprint, they managed to make mistakes in order to be able to track the evolution of the project in Iran. And the Iranian engineers looked at the blueprints, identified the mistake, which was extremely difficult to find, but they found it, and they decided that it was a hoax, And eventually, they decided that making a nuclear weapon in Iran would probably cause more troubles than solutions. And probably it was not a good idea to develop that. And that's the reason why they probably changed their mind and developed ballistic missiles but conventional ballistic missiles, and probably engage in the hypersonic technology, what we have seen in action last year during the two true promise operations of the Iranians, showing that, by the way, you don't need nuclear weapons to achieve success, but having alternative technologies can bring chances of success against Israel. So from that, we can derive the fact that Netanyahu is lying when he's talking about this. He's simply trying to press the U.S. to be involved in Iran. Now, from the Trump perspective, Trump doesn't want to be involved in any conflict. He has understood that being part of a conflict is a waste of money and resources. And what he needs now to make America great again is precisely resources. Human resources, financial resources, industrial resources. He doesn't want... it's not that he doesn't want, but so far, the only industry that survived the Cold War is the military-industrial complex in the U.S. But as we see, the military-industrial complex is probably a source of income for many billionaires, but it's not a solution for a state. You cannot live just based on manufacturing weapons. This is not what the consumers want. You need to have a lot of our other capacities and capabilities. And that's what Trump wants to do. And that's the reason why he wants to spend energy and resources to reshore industry in the US. That's why he wants to disengage from Ukraine, disengage from Palestine, disengage from Iran, and concentrate on China, put pressure on China. Why? Because China is the major competitor to the US. It's very simple. But at the same time, to compete with China involves two things. First, to be able to make China weaker, if I can put it that way. But at the same time, you have to make America stronger. And reshoring industries requires a lot of investments, not just in building new production or manufacturing facilities, but also a lot of effort in terms of training engineers, STEM graduates, as they call it in the US, in the United States, science, techniques, engineering, and mechanical. So, and that requires a lot of investment, and that will also be fruitful, not just in a couple of days, but in a couple of years and all that. Meaning that you need to rebuild those infrastructure. You need to rebuild a training and education system in the U.S. because this is obviously missing. If you compare U.S. to China and even Russia and even some European countries, you'll see that the U.S. has lost his position in terms of having graduates that can assume the development of technologies and all that. Most of the innovations that you find in the U.S. are in fact produced by foreigner brains. You know, these are brains that are imported, and That's the strengths of the U.S. They have the funding for those brains. They are ready to pay for those brains. I have a lot of friends who have their kids coming out of the Zurich Engineer School, which is a very high-rated the Polytechnical School of Zurich is high, very high-rated in the world. But you have a lot of American companies ready to spend a lot of money to have those engineers going to the US. So, because they need brains, they don't have enough brains in the US. So, if you want to have in the long term this competition with China, you have to rebuild that. And not just that, you also have to rebuild an infrastructure. You have to build a network of railways, of highways, and so on and so forth. In electricity, for instance, also is a problem in the U.S. The U.S. is one of the countries that has the most failure in the power grid because these are all private companies, so they tend to save money on maintenance. As a result, you have a very aged power grid system that collapsed at every time. So that's especially true in the on the west coast of the US. So all that requires a lot of investment, a lot of resources, a lot of human resources and all that. So there is no room for war. And that's the reason why Trump tries to be disengaged from those wars. That's the positive aspect. That's the positive aspect. I'm not sure the way he's taking to address these problems and to achieve these objectives. I'm not sure the way is the best one. And when we talk about the way, we are talking about the strategy is probably not the best one with tariffs and all that. Again, that's can be debated by, we can debate that. But this is the idea. And on a certain sense, I think the intent is a good intent. And the problem is that those people like Netanyahu, who try to have others making war for them, are the spoilers of peace. And we have seen that with Netanyahu. He has a strategy of provocation for everyone in the region. They never managed to have a consistent foreign policy in order to have good relations with their neighbors. They don't want to have good relations. It's very strange. It's a very strange culture that they would like to be loved, but they make everything to be hated. Try to understand that. For me, it's beyond understanding, but that's the way it is. And they are hated. But okay, so there's no real surprise there. So that's a little bit the situation in which we are. And again, the problem is that when those people like Netanyahu are feeling that they are losing ground, they might be tempted to do irrational things. And that's the danger. And we have exactly the same thing with Zelensky, by the way. And they are the same culture. They come from the same region, from the same area. They have the same culture, the same way of thinking. And we see this, we have addressed that a couple of times already, that you have a lot of similarities in the way Netanyahu and Zelensky deal their own crisis by refusing any kind of negotiation, trying to impose their solution to others and failing because they don't have strategies. They illustrate perfectly something that I probably have already said in your program, but I think it's very true with both of them, is what Sun Tzu used to say 3,000 years ago, or 2,500 years ago, saying, strategy without tactics is just noise before defeat.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much, Colin, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
That was my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. Thank you.